Welcome, everybody, to another episode, our second season of Doc Talk. I am Captain Jeff Monroe. I am one of the hosts of this wonderful program, and I'm the Director of Education Programs and Senior Management Advisor for the International Association of Maritime and Port Executives. And my co-host, Amy Andrus, who is Executive Director of the Inland Rivers Ports and Terminal Association. Amy, as always, a pleasure to be hosting these programs with you.
And likewise with you. Thank you so much, Captain. I appreciate that. For our listeners and our guests today, I'm so excited to introduce you to my mentor, Mr. Jim Kearns with Jones Walker. Thank you for joining us on our Doc Talk episode. And also joining Mr. Kearns is ATN with Jones Walker. ATN, would you give us just a brief snippet, if you could, about Jones Walker?
Sure. Jones Walker is a law firm centered in New Orleans, but all over the Gulf South, and including all the way up to St. Louis with Mr. Kearns. And we have, I think, we like to say one of the biggest, if not the biggest, maritime groups in any full service law firm. We've been around for a long time, actually founded by people, by river people in New Orleans way back in the beginning of the 1900s. And we've got a large group that does just about anything somebody in the maritime business would need. So hope that answers that question.
It is. It's so good to finally meet you virtually, and I'm so glad that you could both be with us on this Doc Talk episode today.
Very happy to be here.
So, of great attention right now in Louisiana specifically is this Louisiana Port Authority Advisory Act. I know there's a lot of buzz going on in the industry about what this is, what this bill will do, and what it means for the stakeholders, both public and private, in the state of Louisiana. Is there anything more that you could tell us about that?
Well, being a lifelong Louisiana resident, I remain skeptical as to what will actually happen with this discussion. Listeners might know, or people that follow the issue might have picked up, we've got a new governor who sort of takes a very different tact to prior governors. And one of his various commissions to sort of improve the state and its functioning was to appoint a ports and infrastructure commission, which is studying a lot of different things, which, as I understand it, includes the issue, Amy, that you talked about. We are peculiar in the sense that we've got a lot of river and we've got a lot of political subdivisions that run public operated docks on these river. I forget what the count is. Captain Monroe may know what it is, or Jim might be able to help me out here, but there are a lot of them. And each one of them is their own little fiefdom. Each one of them has their own specified jurisdiction. And whether they compete with each other, who knows? I'm not here to talk about that. But I think the governor's feeling on it seems to be that he would like to see more consolidation or more cooperation amongst these various entities in a way that benefits the state overall as opposed to specific jurisdictions. And so I'm sort of taking a wait and see approach to see what comes of it. As I said, I'd be very surprised if you saw, I would be very surprised if we saw a consolidation, but I know it's a hot topic and one that that people will be watching.
Back in the 1990s, I was the executive director of the Seaport Commission in Massachusetts for the Commonwealth, and Governor Weld was the governor at that time. One of the things that came out of the recognition of all of that was the fact that there needed to really be a sort of coordinated discussion between not only the ports of Massachusetts, but also the surface transportation, the people who are dealing with the maritime issues and all the rest of it. And we've formed the Seaport Advisory Council up there, which was actually headed by the Lieutenant Governor and had the Commissioners of Transportation, the head of Massport, Environmental Affairs, all the key players in there, as well as representatives of each of the ports. And I remember I was asked by the Times-Picayune what my sort of feeling about this whole thing was, about this whole discussion. And I says, I think it is certainly to the benefit of a state for their ports, their transportation entities, their surface, their water systems, all to be working in concert with each other. Because while we tend to think of ourselves as all these little parochial neighborhoods, the bottom line is that Louisiana, which of course is the largest exporter or one of the largest exporters right now of commodities, you know, in the United States, is that they compete not only with other regions of the United States, but they also compete certainly with, you know, with each other, but also with nationalities, you know, Mexico, Canada, you know, and places around the world. So, you know, it certainly has been a very strong action on the part of most of the states now to look at the aspect of coordinating transportation and ports together. Question is, what's that form like? Because I've certainly had feedback from, after that article came out, from some of the people in some of the ports, and there are 32 ports, you know, I guess that are tentatively involved in all of this, who basically said, well, we like our autonomy, you know, we don't like mind working together. The issue becomes is we don't want to be domineered, you know, we don't want anybody to be dominant and tell us what to do, you know, and that's sort of that really fine line we walk.
We've got a lot of big C words being thrown out here: consolidation, cooperation, and coordination. If I look at the impact, the potential impact of 32 different public ports being consolidated, I really hope that the governor's office moves more towards cooperation and coordination than consolidation. And here's an example. The state of Alabama, if you look at their structure, they have a statewide port structure, being the Mobile Alabama State Docks. And look at the impact that having a one port state structure has on those smaller communities further upriver of the Tennessee River. A lot of the funding is going to the Alabama State Docks, and a very little of it is going to those ports up north that are really impacting their communities.
Yeah, so I would tend to agree with Captain Monroe, and he made this observation. You have 32 individual fiefdoms, all of whom like the idea, but none of whom like the idea of losing autonomy. So I suspect if anything does come out of this, it's going to be the middle C, Amy, that you mentioned, which is cooperation. And hopefully, and look, taking off my legal hat, taking off my advocate hat for your client, just as a resident of Louisiana, one of the most disturbing trends that we've watched for the last 20 years is us lose market share to what used to be the predominant artery through which trade in the U.S. happened, right? We've lost market share to Mobile, we've lost market share to Texas, and we've got a lot to offer. But I think the lack of overall cooperation has allowed for things like infrastructure. And again, to Captain Monroe's point, it's not just on the water. It's trucks, it's rail, it's everything. And the lack of improvement and focus on an overall efficient system has probably put us behind other jurisdictions, whether they're operating as a single state or as a cooperative state or however you want to put it. And so just as a citizen of Louisiana who has an economic interest in the state, I hope that we move towards at least a cooperation. But then even on a cooperation model, you have competition, right? Who, if an improvement is just for one port, is it for all the ports? Who's going to benefit? And how do we manage it in a way in which everybody stays happy? So I don't envy whoever the chairman of this committee is, but I wish them great success.
Or her.
I think I know enough to say it was a him, but yeah.
So Jim, how do you feel that this potential legislation would impact private terminals?
Well, to be honest, I'd have to defer to ATN or those who are more familiar with this jurisdiction. As you know, my world is very much upriver, in St. Louis, and so in a number of public ports, of course, operate through, they operate through tenants. I mean, so they may be, they may have terminals that are resident on their port. And so those terminals would be the ones to, in a sense, both benefit or bear whatever burden that might be coming out of this. So that's what I would think would be the consequence on the private side.
Yeah, so Amy, I would take a potentially contrarian view or maybe not necessarily easy view of what it would mean. I think if you asked most private terminal operators in Louisiana, I think they would take the rising tide lifts all boats view. In other words, if the state as a whole was able to attract more commerce into its ports, it's going to end up benefiting everyone, not just public ports. And I think, again, maybe I'm being overly optimistic, I think private operators would view it like that. There may be a few wrinkles that somebody would get their feelings hurt or lose some business, but I think overall, an increase in tonnage coming in would benefit everyone.
Etienne, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, the one in Massachusetts has operated successfully for 20 years, and they've dished out, hundreds of millions of dollars, And you're right. What we share is our waterways, we share our roadways, we share our rail infrastructure. And the bottom line is that when those systems were all coordinated, right, and money is flowing, because it's really, a lot of it is about chasing the money, and how is this going to benefit? So the roadway that benefits the public facilities are going to obviously benefit the private facilities as well. So I certainly hope that a level of cooperation comes about. As we see certainly it works in Florida, it works in Massachusetts. They're discussing it up in Alaska about combining their ports. They're looking at the aspect in Tennessee. So, I think it's the right trend, because I think the recognition is that while the ports compete with each other, right, you also compete on a global scale, and hopefully we'll get there. We'll see what the wisdom of Louisiana, where it takes us.
Well, can Captain Monroe just do one more quick point to that, which is, over the sort of the COVID period and the strikes in California and the backlogs there, you, I think, had an opportunity, if you had a coordinated effort, to increase and entice tonnage that would traditionally go to California, to come down through the Panama Canal. Now that's got its own issues now too. But I think you had an opportunity, timing-wise, to create a situation where you could show people in the market that you can do it this way. But that takes a coordinated effort. You can't do it. 32 individual fiefdoms are less likely to do it, in my opinion, than one coordinated state. And so, that's sort of one real life practical example where one could say, perhaps we missed an opportunity.
I've got one more C word for you, and it's contention. I think I love the idea of coordination of the waterways. Each one of these ports, are self-sustaining and successful and look at their operation as just that, successful and self-sustaining. But I do want to add in a couple more C words. That seems to be the trend that we're on is capital construction. If we talk about funding for private terminals and the availability of some of the resources out there for these terminals to invest in their capital infrastructure, Jim, I think there is a bill out there, and I can't remember the House number, the bill number, but there's a bill out there, right, about capital construction?
Yes. So it's HR 4993 for those following along at home. And the original co-sponsors were Troy Carter from here from Louisiana and Mike Ezell from Mississippi. It's now up to 18 co-sponsors, and what it does is it extends a program called the Capital Construction Fund to marine terminals. Now, to understand the significance of that, you need to know what the Capital Construction Fund is about. And that is a program that has been around literally since 1936. So it was created by the Merchant Marine Act of 36. And originally it was designed to to provide an incentive for building vessels in the United States that would be used in the U.S. foreign trade. It was expanded then to vessels used on the Great Lakes and then to vessels used in the non-contiguous domestic trade, which is, I think, Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and most recently into what we call short sea shipping. So New Orleans to Tampa or Miami to New York. But it was never available during all this time to the inland waterways. And the vessel owners and operators for whom it was available were making great use of it. I mean, there are currently something in the order of $2.5 billion in various accounts under the Capital Construction Fund program. About a little more than a year ago, so at the end of 2022, the law was amended to remove those trade restrictions so that now all vessels literally engaged in the foreign or domestic trade of the United States are eligible to participate in this program. The program it's unusual in the sense that it's not a grant program. It is a tax deferral program. It's a way it's best summarized as saying it's like an IRA going in. It's like a Roth IRA coming out, and it works this way, that a vessel owner or operator can take the earnings that they have from their operation of their vessels or their ownership of vessels, and they can deposit those in an account of their choosing. Those funds grow, and they get a tax deduction for doing that. That's why it's like an IRA. The funds grow tax-free in that account, also like an IRA, and kind of the magic of it is that if the funds are withdrawn to construct or reconstruct a vessel, they come out tax-free. And so the funds can be from their earnings or it can be from the sales of their of vessels. So there's a way to, quite honestly, keep this going pretty much forever. And there are companies, again, the ones who have had access to this program, some of them have been in it for more than 50 years, and you can tell from the dollar amounts, it's been well used by the sector that has had access to it. So, as I said, since when the trade restrictions were removed, this created quite a buzz inside the inland waterways community because up until this point they. In the sense would say, well, we weren't given any incentives to build in the United States because we were legally required to do that anyway if we were going to trade between so-called coastwise points, which would include virtually every point on the inland waterways. So we have had a number of, I mean, we've already had clients come to the firm. We've certainly been hearing a lot about it. And the Maritime Administration has been very accommodating in their interpretation of how this newly expanded or newly available program should be administered. They've removed minimum dollar requirements for what you're going to have to put into the fund, because for a lot of smaller operators, you know, they can't commit to huge amounts of money. And frankly, they don't need huge amounts of money. As we all know, you know, the kind of vessels that are used on the inland waterways, well, they cost a lot more than they used to, but they still don't cost as much as the vessels coming in and out of the nation's seaports. Now, that's all by way of background, because your question was about terminals and this bill that's pending. So the bill is to take that concept, that approach, and let terminals on the inland waterways, marine terminals, use it in order to take their earnings and use those to acquire the kind of equipment that they are being asked to get or to put into operation to reduce emissions at the ports. And so in order to get some help with that, I mean, there are grants available. Certainly the EPA makes those available. The Maritime Administration has just announced, you know, a large amount of money that's available to the Port Infrastructure Development Program. But with the Capital Construction Fund, this is your money. I mean, this is the operator's money. And so they determine how much goes in. They determine how, when it goes in. They determine when it comes out and for what it and what it comes out for. So that's an entirely different approach. You're not competing with others for grants. It's not. In fact, for example, the last two, I thought it was kind of telling. The last two grant announcements made by the EPA were titled competitions. So it just tells you right away that this is, we're going to have, as we know, and as history has told us, there's a lot more applicants typically than there are recipients of these grants. There's no limit on the capital construction fund approach. There's no reason why, if you want one, you can't have one. You're not competing against.
Well, there is a really good reason why you couldn't get it if you wanted it. And if you don't have that original investment in stockpile of cash, right? You need that initial money to put in it.
Well, you do need to have some spare money to put away. But, you know, that's, I mean, if an operator or owner is living hand to mouth, that's true. They're not going to have anything to spare at the end of the day to deposit. But as we know, you know, the vessels wear out, and it's prudent management to be thinking ahead and saying, so, and if, what am I going to be doing to replace this vessel when it comes to the end of its useful life? That's what the whole concept of depreciation under the tax laws is about, is to say, we're going to give you a deduction for depreciate, be in anticipation that you're going to have to replace this asset, whatever it is. And so you can deduct a certain amount that you don't have to, you know, it's a non-cash deduction. But it gives you the space, if you choose to use that space, to put money aside in those amounts. So the capital construction fund, in a sense, it's not a depreciation account, but it does create the same, it's intended to create the same sort of incentive to say, if you're being prudent and forward looking, you should be putting some money aside. And if you can possibly afford it, this is one way to do it. And this is a way that would let you do it that is tax advantaged. So that's the, so it's in some ways it's a replacement for depreciation deductions. But the big advantage is that, you know, what if you sell the vessel at the end of its useful life, instead of having depreciation recapture, which is what is often a unpleasant surprise for people when they find out that the depreciation deductions they've been taking the IRS clause back as ordinary income upon the sale of a vessel. If you take those proceeds and put them into your account, those proceeds go in tax-free, so you never pay taxes. That's how you keep it going.
So I understand, as a result of the great Chinese crane controversy, the spy cranes, that the administration is putting incentives out there to try to get U.S.-built equipment, capital equipment, such as cranes and stuff, done here in the United States. And talking with some of the manufacturers, they're interested in doing that because of the Buy American clause. That would certainly open up a great deal of opportunity for federal grants to be utilized for purchasing the type of equipment that is necessary. And there's plenty of ground equipment available, you know, top loaders and, you know, reach stackers and stuff like that. But when you start getting into capital equipment like cranes and everything, that's something that's going to have to be addressed in, you know, U.S. build.
That's Cap Monroe. You stole my thunder a little bit. I was going to ask Jim.
Sorry.
Two questions, one of which was, this will be like a capital construction fund CFIUS collision. Like, could you use a CCF fund to buy a ZPMC crane? You covered that angle. And then Jim, is it pending? I mean, everybody knows Congress seems somewhat dysfunctional. Can they pass bills? It's pending. What are the prospects? What's going on with that?
Well, I think the prospects are quite good for the terminal bill because it's not restricted to the inland waterways. I mean, you've got players like L.A. Long Beach, Savannah, Chicago, New Orleans. The large deep water ports are as interested in this as are the smaller ports. In fact, you know, the unions are backing it. I mean, this is, so there's a lot of political heft behind this bill. And so I think that It may not happen this Congress, but I think its long-term prospects are pretty good for that reason.
So for our listeners on this episode, if they are in favor of expanding the capital construction fund to marine terminals, they should potentially be contacting their congressional representation in Congress saying, we want you to support this bill, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And the current sponsors, interestingly enough, are pretty much all coastal. You know, New Jersey, Florida, Texas, well, you know, here in Louisiana, so California. So they're the ones that are, in a sense, getting encouraged by their constituent, or the businesses that are among their constituents, to favor this. I mean, there is, I think, at least one of the co-sponsors is from Illinois. And I know it's Representative Voss from Southern Illinois. But, you know, so there's some recognition that this would be a benefit to the river industry or the river sector of the maritime industry. But it's like the CCF. I mean, it's got a lot of potential. And it's trying to meet a need that looks like it's going to be with us for a while, which is the policy encouragement to deal with air quality at and around our ports and to move as much of that cargo handling equipment to being electrical rather than diesel. So that's just, I think, the fact of life at this point, and the folks behind it are saying, let's do with it what we can.
Yeah, and even that's a discussion too, because of the feedback from the operators regarding electrical equipment versus diesel equipment. And, you know, certainly our cranes are operated electrically. And it takes me back to my argument that I consistently make every time Amy and I talk about, is that the United States needs to have an all-encompassing policy that not only looks at the aspects of how transportation and ports interact with each other, but also that encourages focus not only on the coastal ports, but on the inland ports as well. And, you know, as we say, the last time we had a policy like that, Harry Truman was president, and it's time for us to join the 21st century.
Yeah.
Going back to that international crane spy show, it is more than China now. If you look at the, I watched the EPA Smart Ports webinar on Wednesday that they held this past Wednesday, and they said funds cannot be used for cranes manufactured in China, South Korea, Iran, or Russia. So
South Korea or North Korea?
North Korea. I think it was North Korea.
North Korea.
Yeah, it's the other Korea.
So, the other side.
But you know what? A lot of people don't recognize, and John Nass pointed this out when he was asked about the Chinese spy cranes. He says, most of our drives, you know, even though the cranes are manufactured in these countries, most of the drive systems, the software and the technology is all, you know, European-based. You know, it's German-based or, you know, Austrian-based or something along those lines. So it's going to be fascinating. We always... You know, I think somebody is picturing these cranes walking around at night taking pictures of our ports. I don't know, you know, what fantasy is coming out of this.
They don't need to walk around and do that anymore, Jeff. They have drones for that.
That's true. Good point.
And
satellites.
And balloons. Don't forget
that.
And balloons.
So, Jim, ATN, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. I always truly... absolutely appreciate your knowledge, Jim, that you share with me, with our team, with the members, and the industry as a whole. Certainly a go-to for us all. And ATN, it was so great to meet you, and I know that you're right there by Jim's side, so happy to call on you and welcome you to the team, sir.
Perfect. Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for the invitation, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, good. Well, we'll look forward to chatting with you guys again in the future. And certainly when this whole thing with this Louisiana port legislation is sorted out, and I'm sure we'll have that opportunity. So, and as always, Amy, I always appreciate your co-hosting this with all of us. And I know that it gets out to quite a few people. And we discuss a lot of these issues also in our training programs. And I'm very happy to say that the IRPT is a education partner with the International Association of Maritime Port Executives, and we're very pleased to have so many people who have taken that program through Amy's support and help and everything, and certainly, you know, we hope to see more of our inland people involved in some of these training programs, which are, you know, a lot of contemporary changes going on, a lot of things happening, so.
You know, you and your big C words today.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, C, S-E-A, C.
Oh.
I'm a boat guy. What can I say? Anyway, Jim, ATN, thank you so much for your time today. And thank you, everybody, for joining us on Dock Talk. And we'll look forward to seeing you all next time.
Thank you.
Fair winds and following seas.
There we go.